You're too damn white, guys.
Welcome back to another Too Damn White Guys. I'm Julian Smith.
I'm Andrew Reeder.
How you doing, Andrew?
Oh, yeah, not too bad, I guess.
Been a crazy week for both of us, I gather.
Yeah, always busy these days.
I'm just going to tell everybody listening, just from the get-go, this is the least prepared Andrew and I have ever been for an episode, because it's just been one of those weeks, but we didn't want to, miss an episode, so we're recording anyways. We do have some material, but this is just going to be a really casual chat about Apollo 11, which by the time you guys are listening to this will have been 2 days ago. We're recording this on Saturday, so today is the anniversary of the moon landing, Apollo 11. 50 years, right?
Yep, 50 years.
So we're going to be talking about Apollo 11 a little bit. We're also going to be talking about Ilhan Omar, the infamous send her back victim. This is, I can't just constantly...
It's actually four congresswomen. It's not just her. It's like four different ones that were talking about Trump. Yeah.
But she was the main target though, right? Of the send her back.
Is that true? I'm not even sure. I think it was kind of all four, but yeah.
Like I said, guys, this is going to be a very casual chat today. Very loose. But, you know, mainly, we actually should have changed this line to be about Trump and, you know, because that's really who it's about. It's like, how could he get, like, a crowd of thousands of people to chant send her back and then backpedal on social media? Actually, he's backpedaled a little bit on social media, but I've also heard he's leaned into it and he's like, there was some other, mayor of London or something, like, tweeted at him defending him and he retweeted it and... Did you hear about that?
Yeah, he's done both. So he's taken two fundamental tacks on this. Basically, what he did was he tweeted originally, you know, these congresswomen are attacking our country. If they don't like it here, they should go back to where they came from and fix the problems in their horrible, poorly run,
crime-ridden country or something like that.
Yeah. Which, you know, is basically a racist trope saying, you know, send them back because, like, they're Americans. All four are American citizens. Three of the four were born in the United States. You know, they have far greater tenure in this country than, say, his wife, for example. And obviously,
his response is the opposite of taking your ball and going home.
Like, the idea behind it is, anyone who's not white, basically, who doesn't speak English as a first language, is not, like, as American as anyone else, right? Which is, you know, the whole racist thing. On the other hand, it does have sort of plausible deniability, which is why he's trying to deny that it's racist, because he's basically saying, well, you know, everyone came from somewhere. And this is kind of funny that Kellyanne Conway was, like, asking reporters, like, hey, so what's your, like, background? Are you from, like, Ireland and England originally or something like this? And you could go back there, right?
That's what I was about to say. It's like, what right. constitutes an American anyway? Like, you know, is it just people from Europe?
Well, you know, the reality of the human species is that everyone's been walking around, wandering from, originally we're all Africans, right? And the Native Americans came here like 14,000 years ago. So they're actually relative newcomers. Even 14,000 years may seem like a long time, but humans have been around for a lot longer than that. And then the Inuit came here much later than the original Native Americans. And then, of course, people of European and African descent came here much later than that. So anyone who's not a Native American is definitely, like, relatively new in terms of human evolution to the continent. And then there's even more recent immigrants. So it's all just the history of humanity is patterns of movement.
Right. Maybe that's what the Native Americans should have said to us when we got here is send them back.
Right. Well, I'm sure they did. They definitely did say that, but we basically said F you and killed them. So yeah, more or less.
Yeah. I hate it when people try to defend, I've used that point a few times, mainly with conservative people. I tend to find myself saying that about, like, the Native Americans and stuff. And one thing I hear constantly is that the Native Americans weren't mistreated or slaughtered by Americans. They all died out from diseases once the Americans got here because they were exposed to new diseases. And I'm sure that that's probably partially true, but, like, you can't tell me that the Indians weren't slaughtered. Like, my neighborhood growing up was built on the Trail of Tears. Right. And we used to find artifacts and stuff in the woods back there. And you know, there was, it's, you can't deny it. Like there was some shitty stuff happened when we got here. Oh,
so it's definitely true that the vast majority of Native Americans were killed by disease.
Oh, it is true?
The vast majority were killed, without
the majority?
Even the Europeans necessarily knowing about it. Oh, yeah, the vast, vast majority, like 90% or something. However, that doesn't mean that there weren't deliberate acts of genocide. It doesn't mean that, European immigrants and European newcomers, colonists and whatever, kind of totally exploited the situation and, sometimes encouraged that and things. So there's plenty of blame, absolutely, even despite the fact that the vast majority of Native Americans were killed by disease. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, they were used as slaves, the Native Americans.
Smithsonian Museum of Native American History, that's like the first thing you encounter is just this big map of the population density of the Americas and how many were killed by disease. It's the vast majority, for sure.
Oh, wow. I didn't know it was the vast majority. I thought it was just something stupid that people said when they wanted to deny.
Yeah. They were absolutely enslaved, by the Spanish in particular, Columbus, when they came over. Hispaniola was down from the original population of Hispaniola, which is the island with Haiti and Dominican Republic, had 40,000-50,000 native inhabitants. And within 40 years, they were basically completely eradicated by disease, but also by definitely deliberate, cruel treatment and enslavement. Yeah. The Spanish had a system called encomienda, which is basically like feudalism in Europe, where a Spaniard was given a territory and basically given a group of Native Americans to rule over. And they worked them to death in mines, especially in South America. Like in Bolivia, there was Potosí, which is the biggest silver mine in the world. It was basically a mountain made out of silver. They had to use mercury to extract the silver. So they had Native Americans go into the mines and they were exposed to mercury fumes all day, and they died from nervous system disease within like a year or less and stuff.
Oh my God.
In fact, that's the reason why Africans were brought over as slaves, as because they originally enslaved the Native Americans, but they died. They all died from disease and stuff, so they had to bring in new labor. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the original Americans are like, we got to subjugate someone. We got to find someone to subjugate. It's just like...
The Spanish colonists and English colonists as well in the Americas. But yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this was supposed to be an intro to the episode, but we just spent a bunch of time talking about
slavery,
Native Americans and the send her back comment. So I think we can probably put that one on the shelf for a little bit. The third thing we're going to talk about, and we should backtrack at some point and probably start with the Apollo story, because I want to get into that with you. I think that's probably the most interesting. It's probably the meat of this episode. But the third thing we're going to cover is the Iranian seizure of oil tankers that happened this week. Between the three of this is like a week in review episode kind of thing, I guess. So that's what we're going to do. Do you want to backtrack and talk about Apollo 11?
Sure. Yeah. So it's been 50 years, and as of release of this podcast, it will have been 50 years and 2 days since the moon landing, basically the first time humans have walked on another world. And actually the only time, apart from five other Apollo missions, there were six missions that landed on the moon until 1972, I think was the last one, left in December 1972. So just for a period of less than 3 years. And actually, to me, it's kind of sad. I find this a very sad anniversary because it's been half a century and we haven't gone anywhere else, basically. And Carl Sagan asked this question, is it a sign of maturity or a sign of lack of ability? So, we haven't basically challenged ourselves to go out and surpass that great achievement from 50 years ago. We kind of did it. Now we're resting on our laurels. And it is true that there is sort of a national effort at the time. Like NASA's funding was about six times proportionally what it is today and what it's been ever since. Because it was the whole point of going to the moon was just to capture the spotlight from the Soviets. It was during the Cold War, and the Soviets were winning the Cold War, because they'd sent people into space, and it looked like Soviet technological prowess was, winning the hearts and minds around the world. And Kennedy made a famous speech to Congress where he said, where he committed the nation to, before this decade is out, to land a man on the moon and return him safely to Earth.
Right.
But in that same speech, just a few lines earlier, he says, in this space contest, which has galvanized public opinion around the world, and people are making a choice which path to choose between capitalism and freedom and communism and tyranny, basically. So he's saying that the whole reason to go to the moon is just so people won't become communists, basically, and won't join the join up with the Soviet Union, and they'll think America is great. So the whole thing, and this is pretty clear. This is actually this is why Republicans actually tend to be more pro-space, in a sense, at least pro-human space flight, rather than just sending, like, robots for scientific purposes. Because there's not, if you think about it, like, other than sort of long-term Star Trek vision, like, we need to go out and settle other planets, what is the purpose of sending people into space? And it's kind of just for, like, national prowess. It's like a signal that, hey, we're the best. It's like flags and footprints and rah-rah America and look what we can do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that whole nationalism pride thing is like a more Republican kind of virtue. So Republicans, like Mike Pence, is super into getting humans to the moon by 2024 because that would be the end of Trump's second term if that were to happen. So, at the time, it was bipartisan support. I think there is bipartisan support for space, but it tends to be angled a little differently. Democrats definitely think space is super useful from the science and from the perspective of, like, monitoring the Earth for global warming and climate change, whereas Republicans tend to be more about the rah-rah America. Let's put people, like, do the most amazing accomplishments.
Rah-rah, we were first again.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I kind of lean towards both, but in a sense, I'm almost more on the Republican side in this argument, because I do think it's important, not from a nationalistic standpoint, but from a achievement of humanity standpoint, which...
Yeah, it's competition.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, that's the other reason why maybe if you try to involve the whole world, it might not be as effective, because national competition is a huge stimulus. I think that the reason why Europe had such a technological advantage because it had so much competition. If you just look at Europe's geography throughout time, we're getting into so many subjects here, I guess, but it's divided up into so many different parcels of land and so many rivers flowing outwards and so many jagged coastlines. The coastline of Europe is like, 5 times greater than Asia's coastline, even though Asia is 5 times larger, right? It's just Europe is such a jagged coastline, all these seas, the Mediterranean and the Baltic and the Black Sea and stuff, that encouraged trade, it encouraged small parcels of land, encouraged competition, and, you know, that's what I think gave Europe its technological advantage, just this kind of dynamicism. So competition is important.
Yeah, I agree. It is important. As an aerospace engineer, do you think there is any utility to continuing to go back to the moon? Because that's one thing I keep, like, whenever I see these headlines, like, people want to go to the moon again. I'm like, why? Like, why do we want to go back to the moon? Why not, like you were saying earlier, why don't we expand our horizons and see how much further we can get? Why don't we make the focus Mars? Why is everybody still rushing to the moon?
This was an interesting point because in the White House, the Oval Office this week, Trump had Jim Bridenstine, who's the administrator of NASA, and he also had the two remaining Apollo astronauts, Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins, who were on Apollo 11. And he kind of put Bridenstine, the administrator, on the spot because he said, hey, what about, like, just going to Mars and kind of skipping the whole moon thing? And Bridenstine had to give, like, the NASA answer. It's like a training, it's a proving ground and stuff like this. I mean, it comes out of the question, is it like a matter of responsibility? It's expensive for sure. And NASA's budget doesn't allow, I think, you know, at least under the current sort of plans, to go to Mars direct. Although, you know, there's this whole Mars direct plan, which is by Zubrin, which is about living off the land and manufacturing all your oxygen and your methane rocket fuel on Mars. I kind of think that's a really good approach, and it's a way to do it much more easily so that it could actually be done. But there's no question that it's much riskier. And I think that humans have become far more risk averse since we were explorers back, you know, hundreds of years ago. This is what my book is about, which I know you started reading. But about, you know, we're not willing to take risks. Like, we have much greater medical technology today, but people say, like, we shouldn't send people to Mars, or we shouldn't send people, you know, into dangerous situations unless they have access to medical technology. But all this medical technology was only invented in the last couple hundred years. So for the incredibly vast majority of our existence, we had no access to medical technology, and we decided to do these amazing things like sail around the world. And yeah, when we sailed around the world with Magellan, about like 90% of the people died. But it's considered like the most successful. Well, right. I mean, I'm not suggesting we should embark on voyages where 90% of the people die, but we should be willing to take greater risks, right? Than we are, right? To consider a necessity of maintaining our medical technology, that makes it an impediment. It'd be like worse to have it. You'd be better off if you didn't have the medical technology, because then you wouldn't have to feel that you needed it, right? Like, for certain bold first step initiatives, we have to be willing to take greater risks. It's the only way we're going to do them at all, right? And humans have sort of lost perspective on that, I think. We live such safe, comfortable lives nowadays that we've totally lost perspective on that. So, and, you know, NASA has become a much more bureaucratic organization. And it has to be mission-driven. Like, at the time, the whole purpose was to beat the Soviets in the Cold War. Now we don't kind of, like, have as much of a driving force, right? Mm-hmm. It's unclear what the driving force is. Maybe China. Like, China strides in space. India's going to fly humans. But they're still a long way from surpassing U.S. space achievements. So, yeah.
Yeah, but going to the moon doesn't seem like it's going to accomplish any of the stuff that you're like.
Yeah. Yeah. So the question about going to the moon, I think there is a purpose to go to the moon. The question is whether that purpose is large enough to mean that we should go to the moon first rather than going straight to Mars or something like that, which is an interesting question. I definitely have strong sympathy. My view is that probably it's not really worth going to the moon, but I kind of question whether NASA would even be able to skip the moon in a sense, because it's just not structured in a way that's it's able to take such large risks, right?
You mean so the large risk being going to Mars?
Going to Mars directly without kind of building up first. So I guess I would prefer NASA to go to the moon, back to the moon, over doing nothing, which is what it's currently doing. So I kind of view any destination as preferable to no destination. So if we're
going to going to the moon is a warm up or something?
Yeah, going to the moon is better than doing nothing, basically. And
well, maybe not, though. Like, what is it going to accomplish?
Well, so we've landed 6 times on the moon. We spent a total of about, I think, 24 hours of surface exploration or something like that, saying that we've been to the moon at equatorial sites only. So, or close to equatorial. So basically saying we've gone to the moon is like landing in 6 different shopping malls in America and saying we've explored Earth, right? It's like we've barely scratched the surface. The thing is, the moon is kind of less varied. Like, there's less stuff there. It's less interesting. It's so, you know, what do you get from exploring the moon? You get a lot of geology. Like, you know, it definitely excites certain scientists and stuff like that. There's the lunar far side. So, which is shielded from Earth, because one side of the moon is always facing Earth, the other side is always facing out into space.
I saw your tweet about this, yeah.
You could build space telescopes and stuff like that that don't have any interference from Earth. So there's, like, things you can do. There's also, because the moon has less tilt, there's places at the pole which should have permanent ice, but right next door, like in a crater, but right next door on a mountain, there's places where they get full sunlight all the time. So you could have really efficient energy generation right next to water. So there's potential ice. Potentially you could, you know, make a rocket base for refueling or something like that. I think people underestimate how difficult it is to do operations like refueling in space. So, and then you have to bring all the infrastructure there, and basically you know, it's true that the fuel required to go from the moon to Mars is vastly less than to go from Earth to the moon, even, let's say. But it's just, you're taking the whole challenge and moving it off the planet, which seems very difficult to me. So I kind of think all those arguments for going to the moon are not strong enough to mean that we should go to the moon first. I kind of do definitely feel that we should go to Mars first. Now, there are other good reasons to go to the moon, like tourism, for example. Like if you want to have a really cool space trip that's only a week long, you definitely can't go to Mars, but you could definitely go around the moon. That's pretty awesome. So
that's an expensive, you know, tourism trip.
It sure is, but there are people who can afford it on Earth. So, and it could, you know, generate a lot of capability to be able to go to Mars. So there are definitely valid reasons to go to the moon. But yeah, I mean, in my view, the purpose of going to space is to cross it and get to the other side. It's like, why do we build boats? Not to like cruise around. Well, we do for fun, I guess, too. But you know, historically, the main reason to build ships that sail the ocean is to transport people and ideas and goods across oceans, right? It's for transport, it's for commerce, it's for immigration, it's for all kinds of
survival.
Yeah, it's not just, I would say more flourishing than survival.
Flourishing, yeah, that's the word.
We could have survived. So humans are unique in being the only species that occupies the entire planet, basically. I mean, there's like bacteria, obviously, they do, and rats, and sort of the animals that kind of tag along with us. But we as a species are not native to the entire planet. We're native to a small part of Africa.
Right.
And without technology, we wouldn't be able to survive outside of Africa. We wouldn't, you know, without fire, without clothing,
yeah,
without shelter.
Agriculture.
These are all technologies that we invented to survive outside of Africa, basically.
Yeah.
We can only survive, like, if we're naked without technology in Africa. And, like, even that would be obviously very difficult without even, like, a spear to defend off the lions, right?
Which is hilarious to hear you say it that way, because I've never thought of it like that, but it's totally true. And it's funny because if you take the, and this isn't to rag on the Bible, but when you look at the Genesis creation account, it's like they say that the Fertile Crescent, where Eden was, is the origin of life. And that's where everybody was originally naked and survived without technology. But it was actually way further south than that. And
well,
way
do they
earlier.
Even specify a place? I didn't know that they specified. I mean, the Bible was certainly invented in the Fertile Crescent, but I didn't think the Garden of Eden was specified to be anywhere in particular.
Well, scholars will argue over this, but the Old Testament actually references Eden's location as between the Euphrates and Tigris rivers.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and also Enoch, which is the first metallurgy ever. Mm. It was founded right there. It claims to be right outside of Eden, so it would have been right around there. But you'll hear Bible scholars argue over this.
Fascinating. I thought it was just kind of like a random place in the sky or something like that. Yeah, like,
yeah,
because it's not a real place. So I thought that even Bible scholars would have thought it was kind of metaphorical or something like that, not like literal. So
yeah, some of them do, but my personal favorite scholar, Richard Elliot Friedman, he's the guy that you always see on like the History Channel and the Bible documentaries and stuff. He's like the man, and he says that there's reason to believe it was an actual place. Now, it's not that story is an actual story that should be taken seriously, but that, like, this is, you know, where these, it's a...
Thought it was. People thought it was. Yeah.
It's probably a blurry line. That whole account is probably, like, because, for example, like, Adam and Eve, I think most people would probably say, like, are they even real people? Yet, Cain, who is the son of Adam and Eve, was definitely a real person who founded Enoch, which is right outside of Eden. So it's kind of a
Wait,
the whole
what?
Thing seems a little.
Wait.
Yeah.
Hold the phone. You're saying Cain. Why do we think Cain was a real person?
Because he founded the first major metropolis in that area, Enoch. They had the first metallurgy.
How do we know a person named Cain founded us? I'm not denying that a town was found archaeologically that. You know, may have had early metallurgy and stuff like that. But how do we know it was founded by a guy named Cain?
Because Cain had a son named Enoch, and that's what he named the city after.
Isn't it more logical to suppose that people would have named the character after the city that existed? So they're like, hey, the city, oh, it's probably founded by a guy who's named that.
This is also stuff Bible scholars will argue about. But there is a
So think about it, like the whole story is ridiculous. The fact that you would have like two people creating all the other humans, and I guess they're like marrying their sisters and stuff like this.
Naturally.
Like, yeah.
There were how many people like on the planet back then?
It's a pretty small gene pool, right?
Exactly. It's amazing we're not all autistic or something.
Well, right. I mean, yeah. Having all of humanity come from two people is a really small gene pool. It's highly unlikely that that would be, you know, a sustainable way to start a civilization. On the other hand, there is some evidence for there being significant bottlenecks in the human past. But these are a lot older than any of the biblical stories would be. They're like 75 million years or something like... No, not 75. That's before the dinosaurs. I mean, 75,000 years.
Big difference.
Yeah, big difference. Yeah, one is the dinosaurs, one is early humans.
The last biblical thing I'll say before we go back to the Apollo thing, the most interesting thing to me about the whole like two person creation narrative idea is that, you know, it is the Noah, the flood story, which, you know, science now says there was most likely a regional flood in that area. We know it wasn't, there's no way it could have been a worldwide flood, but there was a Babylonian flood account that predates the Noah story by 2000 years. So it's interesting that like, this place where this flood happened, there was two people that started a civilization. It's like maybe they were survivors of some great flood and they just started over in that area or something.
Yeah, why would it just be two people? It seems pretty simplistic to imagine it would be two people rather than like 200 people or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And these are just like one band, right, of people. There's presumably, actually, there's definitely historically other bands of people, because there's people living in China, there's people living in North America, there's people living 100%. In Africa. So, yeah.
Not to mention China predates them by thousands of years.
No, the flood myth is very interesting, because the Black Sea was probably created by a flood, a gigantic flood, like 7,000 years ago, when early humans were kind of coming up with these stories. Because it was isolated, the Bosporus, from the Mediterranean, which itself was cut off about 5 million years ago. So there was like a series of two giant floods, potentially.
Interesting.
And this was right in the right area, that, with the Black Sea being formed basically by a giant flood.
So it interesting.
Flooded all kinds of villages and stuff.
We're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're coming right back. I promise. Okay, so now we've added a biblical topic to our list for today. Let's go back to Apollo. How did we get to the Bible from the Apollo 11 story?
I don't remember. It's been a long, crazy road.
Leave it to us. Yeah. So where were you in the Apollo 11 thing? If you want to,
I think
we
were talking
up.
About the merits of going to the moon versus going directly to Mars. And I think obviously there's much more value in going directly to Mars. But the question is, are we as humans, as NASA, as an organization, capable of doing that? Capable of taking the risks necessary to do that? I'm not really sure, actually.
Well, I've heard you say that, and I'm not sure if this is your fact or not, but or where you got this, but you've said that on this podcast, you've said that going to Mars today is safer than crossing the Atlantic was, you know, 1,000 years ago or something like that.
I think that the hardships involved in going to Mars are less than, say, going to Australia a few hundred years ago from Europe, possibly crossing the Atlantic. But that's exactly my point. We've changed, I think. You know, we're more risk averse. We're not willing to do the things that we've done in the past, which is super sad.
But it's scary.
That's sort of another kind of doomsday scenario for humanity, is that we just become apathetic and lazy and risk averse and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's a big question. Yet more people than ever are climbing Mount Everest. There's these stories about overcrowding on Mount Everest.
But people die.
Yeah, I think like 6% of people die. But it's now because they're all amateurs. They're not even good climbers. Like any person can go, because basically the Sherpa does all the work.
Right.
The Sherpas do all the work.
I've heard there's now a time limit for selfies at the top.
Yeah, exactly. Because everyone's just trying to get the selfie so they can post it in their office. Yeah, no, I know. It's and Everest is covered in garbage and dead bodies and stuff like that. So, yeah.
But I guess if you climbed Everest, you'd want to take a selfie, right? That would be like the time to take a selfie.
Yeah, I guess. But it's easier.
I still don't know if I'd do it.
So there's this, I guess, Indian couple who faked their picture at the top of Everest.
A deep fake from India?
So I think that, like, it makes a lot more sense. It's better for humanity. It's better for the planet if you just fake your selfie, right? Why not? So kudos to those people, right? It's doesn't do harm to the natural environment, and, yeah, you just fake it.
That's some serious risk aversion right there, faking your selfie for Mount Everest.
climbing Mount Everest is pretty risky. So, and the thing is too, like, what's the point really? I don't know. Yeah. Maybe I'm kind of naive or something, but I don't really understand the point of climbing up the mountain.
Well, that's kind of how I feel about going back to the moon. Yeah. I mean, and I'm not a space guy or aerospace engineer or any, I don't know anything about space really, but just from knowing history, I'm like, why would we go back again? It doesn't, unless there's some reason, like to put a refueling station or something, like you said, that makes sense. But sounds like you're saying that's pretty difficult. So I don't know.
Yeah, to me, I mean, it's obviously not about going to the moon specifically, unless you're just doing it. I mean, the argument from NASA Bridenstine is that going to the moon helps you prove out space technologies and get you familiar with space operations. Thing is, I question whether, the memory timeline is long enough, right? Like, we went to the moon before, so that was a training ground, but now it's been 50 years, so we've kind of forgotten everything. So by the time, we learn it, and then you have, like, turnover of people and expertise and stuff like that, and you kind of, like, then forgot everything, right? So,
it'd be interesting to hear what Buzz Aldrin thinks about someone of these old OGs, moon landing guys. Like, see what he thinks about this stuff.
Michael Collins and Buzz Aldrin are both, I think, definitely proponents for going to Mars directly and skipping the moon.
Huh.
But I also wonder, so that's, it might be a reflection of their generation and the less risk aversion, possibly partly a frustration with, bureaucracy and politics that, sort of crept in, I guess, at NASA and stuff. And partly a reflection of they're kind of old. So, like, they want to see something important get done. I mean, and so do I. Like, I want to see something important get done within my lifetime. And I think everyone feels that way, right? And that's another reason why going to the moon is kind of like, it'd be interesting. But kind of we've done that a little bit. So why not do something better, do something bolder, do something, because as I said, the purpose of going to space is to cross space and get to the other side. And the only really other side that makes sense to get to, I think, is Mars, because it has all the resources necessary to support a technological civilization. So,
yeah. Risk aversion is terrible. I mean, the space stuff isn't the only area where we're becoming risk averse. I mean, like, I've seen it in, the only thing I can really relate it to is in entertainment. And I know that, like, with all the data that the internet has put forward, like, nothing's getting greenlit anymore creatively unless it's from, like, something where troves of data can support it, And it's just, like, people don't take any risks anymore. People are afraid to say, like, this is good, that should go, that's not good, that shouldn't go. People don't want to do that. They don't want to say what's good.
Yeah.
And then you turn on Netflix and there's nothing good on because nobody's taking any risks,
Yeah. And I think in the past, a lot of the successes have been by accident, right? And it's people trying things and experimentation, right? And you have to be willing to take risks to experiment. This is the whole thing with exploring too. Most of the great exploratory achievements were completely by accident, or at least through massive errors in knowledge. Like, if you don't know things, you're willing to go out and try, right? Like, I mean, Columbus was kind of an idiot. He thought that the world was so much smaller than it actually is. And so he got everything wrong and he ignored all the experts. And he discovered something in the process because his geography was so bad.
Right. He discovered Indians.
Yeah, exactly. In a totally different continent. He discovered Indians in a totally different continent.
Guys, there's Indians over here too.
Pretty much. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Same thing with Magellan. He thought the world was much smaller and he thought, I can just sail across the Pacific in a few days. So Yeah.
Yeah, the risk aversion is something that scares me across the board. It's just all the data and stuff is super helpful. And, you know, I think it's great that, like you said, the medical stuff, you know, we have so many more medical resources and technology now. And I think that's all great. But I would just hate to see it continue to make us, you know, take less risks and try
to
new
be clear,
things.
I think it's awesome. Like, obviously, I'm all in favor of medical technology and that kind of thing. I'm just saying that
same
we
here.
Should not insist on needing it for everything.
Yeah,
you know,
same here.
If we're going to go out and explore and do something for the first time, that is inherently a riskier activity, and we should be willing to take greater risks for that.
Yeah. This reminds me of this tweet I saw from Jeffrey Miller, who's been on the podcast a couple of times. He tweeted this today. It was an infographic of a statistic. It says it was about the moon landing, and it's kind of about this risk aversion thing we're talking about. It says half of Britons wouldn't want to go to the moon even if their safe return were guaranteed. This was a poll that was done amongst the general public, and 43% of the public said that they would want to go to the moon even if their safe return couldn't be guaranteed. And 48% said they would not want to go under that circumstance. And this was, he kind of tweeted it under like a sex differences context, because they've got like different numbers for men and women here, like vastly different responses for men versus women. And then what was really interesting to me was the age. As people's age goes up, their risk aversion goes way, way down. So all the young people, like 50 and above percent, said yes, they would go even if their safety wasn't guaranteed. That was like anybody under the age of 40 basically said yes by a landslide.
Yeah, their
and
risk
then,
aversion goes up, you mean. So as people get older, they become more risk averse.
Oh, did I say it the other way?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You said
yeah,
risk
that's what I meant
goes
to say.
Down. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they get more risk averse as they age. Sorry if I made that confusing. But yeah, the point being, the older people get, the less likely they are to take risks.
Which is
and
crazy,
it makes perfect
right?
sense.
That's so, yeah. No, it's so backwards of how it should be. Because people
who are young,
but this is why people have always recruited young soldiers. Because young people be crazy. And they don't know what they've got to live for. So basically young people are much more willing to pick up a gun and fight for their country because they don't know what they're missing. If they were to die or something. And they also think like nothing's going to happen to them. That's why like young males like skateboard and, you know, do all these like crazy things. Not that skateboarding is particularly, risky, but you know, they're the risk takers basically. And they
100%
and they do, you know, like, which is crazy because, like, if you've already had a great life, you should be theoretically, I guess, less afraid of dying, right? So if you're older, like, it doesn't matter as much. You get less to live for. So you should be more willing to go to the moon and more willing to take, like, crazy risks and stuff like that, right? But people, I guess, I wonder if it's because it's just experience. It's a matter of learning from our mistakes. And old people have made so many more mistakes.
Yeah.
Or it's how like society beats you down, right? Like young people, like kids are willing to ask questions that make them look stupid. This is why kids are like natural scientists, because they don't give an F. Like, I mean, they'll just ask questions, right? And that's why that's what makes them kind of like more curious. Whereas old people have like been taught, don't ask questions because you'll look stupid. And they've been just like corrected all these times. Or I mean, people just get beat down by life. They're not willing to take risks and be curious and stuff.
Well, this study is totally in line with what I was saying earlier about risk aversion and data, the availability of data, and like people taking less risks because of data available. And this study seems to say that the older you get, or arguably the more you learn, the more you know, the more risk averse you become. So
it's kind of like
data. You know, it's like the more you have at your disposal, the more information you have, the less likely you are to take risks. Because the truth is, the world is fucking dangerous. You know, like, like you said, you don't really know that when you're younger, so you just take a bunch of risks. But but I think it's unfortunate and scary that people have this tendency, and it's you know, I want to see people keep innovating, and I think people are getting comfortable, and it's kind of worries me.
I wonder if it can be extended to society too. So it's kind of this parallel as society becomes more mature, as society, we learn more together or whatever, like just as society progresses, society in general becomes less risk averse. Or more risk averse, rather. So less willing to take risks. So it can be extended. I wonder if there's some kind of like civilizational aging that you can do, like how the Roman Empire started out really dynamic in sort of an expansion phase and willing to take all kinds of risks and learned a lot and was super dynamic and then became sort of ossified and old and kind of tired and wasn't willing to do anything anymore.
Camille Paglia has talked about this. You know her?
Yeah, it's kind of the life cycle of a civilization, and it has to do with risk-taking as well. Dynamicism.
Yeah, she's talked about this as it relates to Rome and America, and she's kind of apocalyptic. You know, I think she's super smart, and I'd like to think what she's saying is wrong, but she's also way smarter than I am, so I can't really argue with her, but, you know, her comparisons of Rome to America are pretty interesting.
For sure. Pretty apt, yeah.
Well, we should loop back around to this Trump thing with Send Her Back, because we didn't really get to touch on that for too long. And I think it's, you know, it's important that, you know, people talk about things like this, because the, you know, Trump is just, it's crazy. My stance on Trump is getting so convoluted, because I was, when he got elected, I was so disappointed, but I was also like, okay, well, let's just see what he does. Maybe it'll be great. Maybe he'll, like, you know, just start a bunch of fires and some good shit will come out of it, you know, and I kind of tried to be optimistic. But then, like, after a couple of years, I kind of started being like, okay, like, this guy just needs to be out of the office. And, you know, in the last few weeks, he's done some things that I've really liked, like his tariff work with Mexico I thought was really impressive, how he, like, just strong-armed them into getting exactly what they what he wanted from them. And I thought that was really cool. And he was the first president to go into the DMZ, which was really cool. You know, so he's done some things that are kind of impressing me, but like when I hear stuff like this, it just really aggravates me, because it seems like he's got tons of supporters who are willing to just, like, you know, back up anything he says. And that's not right. It's not okay.
That's why I wanted to talk with Tyler about this, get his opinion on it, because, you know, so there's a kernel of reasonableness in it, right? Like what he's doing, especially from, if you're very patriotic, this is, gets back to our patriotism episode, right? However, yeah, it's like sort of, it's definitely a cover. I think in this case, he's definitely, like what he's saying is definitely like a racist trope, basically. Go back to where you came from because you're not white. That's pretty so much it, right? But, you know, the question is whether it's reasonable to, well, there is a question. This is not the question, but there is a question whether it's reasonable to sort of say unpatriotic things or whatever. And I think definitely yes. But I think a lot of Americans think not really. Like, and it is a big problem. Now, I don't think anything in particular that they're saying is unpatriotic, actually. But from a certain, if you hold certain views, you could see some of the things they say as challenging, I suppose, right? Now, that's obviously not a problem for me, and I think they totally have a right to say all those things. Especially because what Americans should espouse is freedom of speech and the ability for people to express their views. So, yeah, that's why this whole thing is kind of like ridiculous in a sense too, but yeah.
You think he'll get impeached?
No, not likely. Unless maybe if there's a second term or something like that. I just think kind of there's not that much time left. And people and Democrats who would be doing it are going to keep thinking, no, we're just going to try to beat him in the polls, right, at the next election. So at this point, like, the longer it goes, the less likely it becomes, I think.
Yeah, that's probably right. It's probably right. At this point, what's the point?
And it's just not, I mean, if it's not the Democratic strategy, then it's not going to happen. Because the thing is, it won't pass the Senate, so he could still be impeached in Congress. But then in order for it to be confirmed, it would have to go through the Senate, which is controlled by Republicans. So that's not going to happen. I think it has to be 2/3, in fact. So, yeah.
Yeah.
But it is crazy how a lot of Republicans have jumped on side, right? It's to say, this is why I do want to talk with Tyler and see what he thinks about this thing. Part of me also thinks it's a little bit, like the whole thing is a bit silly to some extent. I think it's overblown on both sides, actually. But on the other hand, I'm a white guy. So, like, you know, I don't know what it feels like to be on the receiving end of racism. So, you know, I don't really have a dog in the fight from a standpoint of being able to claim what it feels like to be a victim. So I don't really know. But I don't know. I mean, it's the president saying basically racist things on Twitter. So maybe it is. There is a reason why it's such a big story. It's kind of a political fight, it seems like. Right? It's,
yeah.
People also view things through... They make decisions first and then find evidence to support their decisions. It's kind of like backwards, right? So I think people already have sides, and then they're going to view things through the side that they're on. So this is, I think, why Republicans would get on board. Because, you know, what he's saying or what has said has sort of plausible deniability. And he's not, like, being overtly racist. He's being...
just casually racist.
Well, secret, like, not secretly, but like kind of, it's like coded racism, basically, right?
Yeah, cryptic so racism. You could,
it is not impossible to deny, let's say, right? And that's
because
why
he's right. She's a citizen, but she was not born here. So, like, on those grounds alone is what he was going for. But at the end of the day, like, it's still a racist thing.
It's
nationalism.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Anyway.
Because in that same breath, he's saying, like, your country has way more problems. Why don't you go fix those? Like, it's like a right. double, it's a, you know, it's a double stab.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that was, I think we got a lot out of that one. We got more than I thought we'd get for as little preparation as we were able to do. I hope you guys enjoyed this random chat.
Just kept talking.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great week. If you want to support us, you can do that on Apple Podcasts by leaving a review. We love those, and they're so helpful. You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at Julian Was Here. Andrew is at Mars Raider, and we do these episodes every Monday. We hope to have you back next week.
Thanks for listening.